Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's a totally weird day. Thomas Friedman, in his op-ed in today's New York Times, saying, essentially, don't listen to anything Thomas Friedman ever said about economics. John McCain saying about the same. Oh, it's totally strange. Tom Hartman back in the USA, and pleased to be back, broadcasting live from Green 960 in San Francisco, our San Francisco affiliate, where we're live every day, Monday through Friday, and grateful for it. And it's Wednesday, the 17th of September. A lot to cover, a lot going on in the news. A little bit of history maybe that you didn't even know about, AIG. Did you know it started as a Chinese company? Chinese are very, very involved in AIG, the insurance company. And, in fact, if it were to fail, it's already causing some runs on some Chinese insurance companies. Chinese very nervous about this. I frankly think this has more to do with anything else about why the Fed is stepping in to nationalize, is not quite the right word, but it's damn close, AIG. But anyhow, we'll get into that. We'll get into a whole lot of other things having to do with economics. Gold is up substantially over the last hour, which I think is a good sign. It means that we're not totally out of wealth, that this isn't an absolute screaming liquidity crisis. We'll talk about that as well. First, though, Brad Miner is with us. He's the founding editor of the American Compass Book Club, former literary editor of National Review, author of The Concise Conservative Encyclopedia, and The Complete Gentleman. Brad Miner, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Hartman.
I'm Tom. Glad to have you with us, Brad.
Good to be here.
Your book talks about how the left is committing atrocious campaigns against soldiers, slurring our soldiers, the faithful vilifying Christians, entrepreneurs, including Girl Scout cookies in Walmart, and George W. Bush. As a Christian, as an entrepreneur, as somebody who I think, you know, we should respect the office at least of the president, even if he doesn't necessarily always behave in a way deserving of his respect. And I would say that of some Democratic presidents in the past as well. I don't get it. What are you talking about here?
Well, I'm talking specifically, just to give an example, and the book is full of examples, with regard to soldiers. It's certainly true that there were offenses committed at, for instance, Abu Ghraib. But the question is whether those offenses rise to the level that, say, the New York Times took them in running Abu Ghraib as a front-page story for more than a month, whereas, you know, the atrocities committed on the other side pale the atrocities committed by American soldiers. And
but the other side had not invaded the United States of America. The other side had not taken down a sovereign government that represented no threat to them whatsoever and claimed moral standing as the basis for doing it.
Well, that's an argument against the war, but what I was talking about was the way
and Abu Ghraib was part of the war.
Indeed it was. But the question is whether or not what happened there was something that rose to the level of the kind of coverage that the Times gave it.
I would assume it rose even beyond that level, because we went in there saying, we're here as a moral authority. We're here to save you from an evil guy. We're here to stop terrible things from happening, including the torture of individuals. And what do? We start torturing individuals. And now, in retrospect, we know that not only was this not an isolated incident, Linda England aside, but it's something that went all the way up to the highest levels of command and was even signed off on by both Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. This was a war crime of the first order committed by the United States of America in a war that we were claiming was being done for the most moral of reasons. It seems to me, if anything, your outrage is misplaced, Mr. Miner.
Well, I think that Mr. Hartman, your outrage is over the top, because, I mean, there's no sense in which Rumsfeld or Cheney neither of whom I'm a great admirer of, approved of what those soldiers did in the isolated incident at Abu Ghraib. I have no doubt, I was at a session not so long ago with Judith Miller, where she was talking about having traveled recently in that part of the world, and all anybody wants to talk about still is Abu Ghraib. It was a terrible black eye. It was a terrible incident that led a great many people who might have been sympathetic to what America was in its best intentions trying to do there. It has undermined those best efforts. But the question is whether what happened at Abu Ghraib, and that's what I'm talking about, was as bad as the Times made it out to be, and was the Times attempting to undermine the military, undermine the profession of arms as a part, as one of the fundamental underpinnings of our free society. And
so,
I think they were.
So if the police department in, what town do you live in?
I live in Pelham Manor, New York.
Okay, so if Pelham Manor?
Pelham Manor.
Pelham Manor.
Yeah.
So if the police department in Pelham Manor had a couple of guys on the force, and you discovered that they were involved in NAMBLA or something, or you discovered that they were selling cocaine on the
right.
side. Let's use something that actually happens a fair amount. And it got busted and it got covered. Would covering that story be inappropriate?
Again, I'm not saying that covering the story was inappropriate. It was an outrage what happened at Abu Ghraib. It should have been covered. My point is that the extreme extent to which the Times went to cover that story and to not cover much of what was happening on the good side in the war effort. That
the good
is
side?
The distortion. That is what makes it a smear against
Wait a
the
minute.
Military.
We have now 4.5 million refugees in Iraq. It's the second largest refugee crisis in the world behind Darfur, and arguably larger than Darfur. The best estimates for Darfur now are 3.5 million refugees. 2.5 million internally displaced refugees, 2 million outside. In Syria, you've got 8, 10, 12-year-old girls working as prostitutes openly in prostitution centers that have been set up just for Iraqi refugees. And all the parking lots are filled with license plates, people driving over from Saudi Arabia. You have a disaster of epic proportions. You've got over 100,000 civilians dead, according to estimates by the British government that apparently are conservative. You've got a world inflamed against us, and you've got the Baghdad has gone from having less electricity now than they had before, less water now than before, higher infant mortality than before. By any measure, their healthcare system has been broken. Their wealthy people have fled to Jordan. What is the good news you're talking about?
Well, the good news is that Iraqis are taking control of their lives, that they are becoming increasingly responsible for security in that country. And the statement of things like 100,000 dead, and I don't know, I must say, if I were if I were a lawyer, I would say, citing evidence facts not placed in evidence. I don't know.
I'm citing Lancet, the Journal of the British Medical Association.
Yes, but I think that study was based on flawed research.
And Lancet estimated that the number may be as high as 600.
Yes, but it was based on projections, on some sort of computer modeling thing.
Are you submitting to me, sir, that what we now know is a lie? Dick Armey, the Republican member of Congress, has now come out and said that Dick Cheney came to him and told him that Saddam had suitcase nukes, and that was the basis on which Army lobbied his Republican friends to go for this war. And it was a lie. And Cheney knew at the time it was a lie. Addington knew at the time it was a lie. Rumsfeld knew it was a time of the lie. And Army is furious. This is within the Republicans. Are you telling me that a war based on a lie that led to even one civilian death, if your child had died because Canada had invaded the United States because they thought that George Bush was a bad guy, would you be feeling real good about Canada right now?
I don't feel so good about Canada as it is.
But, no, I'm serious. Think about it for a moment as a parent. I'm a parent of three children. And if somebody came into my country and killed one of my children because they said my president was doing things wrong, I'll tell you, as much as I dislike George Bush, I would be out there with a gun looking for them.
Well, I don't think that's why we went into Iraq. I think that the intelligence that was presented to President Bush suggested strongly, I don't know about the specifics of Army's claim about Dick Cheney, but I do think that what was presented to George Bush at the time by George Tenet, by British intelligence, by a range of other sources that he had to draw upon at the time in the
British intelligence has repudiated that
to him that there were indeed reasons to invade Iraq.
I don't agree with the way that
the war has been carried on. There have been a lot of failures, but I think we've recovered from that, and I think General Petraeus has done a fabulous job turning things around, and I think it will be to the benefit of the Iraqi people. Keep in mind, we're not there to stay. We're not going to stay there. And in fact, I think that country is going to be much better off in the long run because they have been liberated from the tyranny under which they lived. And you're making it sound as though there's a greater tyranny now over them, and I don't think that's
true. I'm saying
true.
There is. We've destroyed their country. We've created 4.5 million refugees. Nobody's disputing that.
Fair to say we disagree about this.
Say that again?
Fair to say that you and I disagree about that.
I think so. Brad Miner, HarperCollins, of course, the publisher. Is there a website that you wanted to mention, Brad?
No, just get it at Amazon.com.
Okay, great. And the book is called Smear Tactics, The Liberal Campaign to Defame America. Brad, good mixing it up with you. Thanks for coming on.
Bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American male. Soul-saving, flag-waving, rush-loving, land-paving, personal friends to the quail. Quite diligently, working so hard to keep the free reins of this democracy. From tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, barefooting, folks singing hippies like me. Tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, porn-watching, lazy ass hippies like me.
Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Green 960. In San Francisco, we're doing a gig here Friday night. You can learn all about it over at green960.com for our listeners in San Francisco. I'll be here all work week. We're also doing some work with Link TV. The Masters of the Universe, how they ran amok and cost us the Earth. The Scotsman writing about this. The slam, 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 like a scene from the gathering of mafia dons. The doors of 30 black Lincolns slammed shut as their besalted occupants stepped out into a Manhattan downpour and into a global financial storm. These were the CEOs of the largest banks and insurance companies in the world coming together, pulled together by the New York Fed in something reminiscent of J.P. Morgan doing much the same back in 1907. So who are these guys and what are they getting? And, you know, what's involved? You know, first of all, Lehman Brothers, it's a venerable institution. It was started in 1844, but it really didn't get big until the 90s, you know. And this guy Fuld became, Dick Fuld became the CEO. And, not doing too badly. So let's just, how does this translate? Okay. Fuld, despite the crash, stands to leave with $65 million based on Lehman's Friday morning stock price of $3.73. That tally includes 8.6 million unrestricted shares worth $32 million. Mr. Prince, Chuck, I'm still dancing Prince. He left Citigroup with a package said to be worth $40 million, also a pension of $1.78 million. He was ousted, by the way, back in October with a retirement package reckoned at $160 million. This is Lynch's, Stan O'Neill. Lynch's Stan O'Neill, $160 million. Jimmy Kane, 15 years at the head of Bear Stearns. He walked away not too bad. He was playing golf, actually, when he heard that his company was going down the tubes. But they sold all their 5.6 million shares in Bear Stearns for $61.3 million. And the couple recently bought two adjacent apartments in New York's plush Plaza building for $28.2 million cash. He, by the way, left with a $30 million golden goodbye. Nice parachute. bought a mock Tudor mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut. So this is how bad it is for these poor guys who are the captains of industry who are losing their companies. As they're losing their companies, they're walking away with millions. And who's bailing them out? You and me. And what are we getting for it? Nothing. Nothing. Except a bunch of conservatives running around saying, "Oh, you liberals, you're slandering us. How dare you?" I mean, how strange does this get? Lehman Brothers, the end of leverage. This from the Asia Times. This is fascinating. The demise of Lehman. You know, first of all, Fannie and Freddie, this is the failure of privatization. Why won't anybody say it? I was watching Cramer yesterday on CNBC, and he's going off like all of a sudden he sounds like Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, for the last 5-10 years, the guy's been a Reagan right winger, and all of a sudden he's going, "Hey, they didn't regulate us well enough. They didn't protect us well enough. You know, Mr. Cox over at the SEC, he's responsible." He's responsible for it because people like you, Mr. Cramer, crazies out there who said deregulation, government is the problem, not the solution. All these crazies were saying, "We need to deregulate the markets. Markets, after all, work just fine without regulations." And what's the result? The predators come out of the woodwork. There's a reason why you have regulations. There's a reason why capitalism, at a small scale, at a relatively small scale, works just fine. Thank you very much. You know, small businesses, medium-sized businesses. But as Teddy Roosevelt in 1913 correctly pointed out, when you get to the level of large business, you're looking at something that has the potential to actually harm a nation. And that's what's going on. That's what's going on in a very, very big way. And here we are bailing these companies out. And, as I said earlier, gold has gone up, I think, $60 in the last hour. And the stock market has gone down a couple hundred points. I believe that, the market going down is something that's not going to stop. We're entering a major bear market phase, in my humble opinion, because there just isn't the money, number one. Number two, they bailed out AIG. Why didn't they bail out Lehman? They could let fail. But AIG is backing, first of all, as I said, it was started as a Chinese company by an American many, many years ago. They are backing our investments all over the world. If AIG went, it would have sparked a worldwide disaster. But you and I get to bail it out once again. By the way, your share of just AIG, your share of that, about $937, if my math is right, this year. Ready to pay the taxes?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
There is so much going on in the world, my friends. There is so much going on in the world. The Hill, this was reported actually on Wednesday, September 17th. And what is today? Today is Wednesday, September 17th. Eureka. Okay. No, I'm sorry. This was first reported on January 26th. I'm looking at today's issue. So here's a story that's about 6 months old, and It's nothing's happening with this. I'm astounded. By the way, have you seen the 2-minute Barack Obama, "I'm here to talk about the economy" video? It's nice. McCain's got a 30-second one, or maybe it's a minute. And in it, he takes a shot at Obama. Why doesn't Obama take a shot at McCain in this thing? It would have been so easy to do. It could have been just done in passing. He could have simply said, "My opponent doesn't get it." I mean, I get it. They're trying to play, run the campaign above the fray and all that, and I think that that's admirable. And I think it's important to take a shot at your opponent. Nonetheless, Here, this from the Hill. If elected president, Senator John McCain would pursue reforms to Medicare that could lead to hundreds of thousands of Florida seniors losing their current prescription drug coverage. Are you listening to this? Well, my friends down there in Miami listening on Wins. But McCain's campaign is not worried that his views in the popular program will hurt him in the Sunshine State. There are 3 million Floridians in Medicare, and about roughly half of them are signed up for the program's prescription drug benefit. Nevertheless, the state voters and the Republican presidential candidates don't appear much interested in talking about the controversial entitlement program. In fact, indeed, during a debate in Boca Raton Wednesday, now keep in mind, this is back in January, a debate partly underwritten by AARP, the candidates did not field a single question about Medicare. McCain has long argued the bill that created the Part D description plan went too far, covering too many people, and putting too great a burden on taxpayers. He believes the drug benefit should only be available to low-income beneficiaries. So John McCain wants to turn Medicare into a welfare program. Why? Because welfare programs are easier to kill. Nobody likes welfare. Everybody, I mean, you know, ever since Reagan and the so-called Cadillac welfare queen, which, by the way, the New York Times tried to track down, ain't no such person. They were unable to find it. They asked Reagan about it. He said he couldn't find it. They asked the campaign. They asked the people. Nobody ever found her. But nonetheless, the meme is out there. It got amplified 100,000 times by the 1,000 or so right-wing radio stations around the country and all the right-wing blog sites and all the right-wing media and all the corporate newspapers over and over and over again and by Mr. Reagan himself. And the result, of course, was that people believe it. So welfare is easy to do away with. I mean, you know, it wasn't that way in the 60s when Lyndon Johnson cut poverty by more than a third, some would argue as much as half in 4 to 6 or 8 years with the war on poverty and the Great Society. It actually worked. It actually worked. It brought all kinds of people into the middle class. But it's not popular anymore, and so McCain wants to convert Medicare into welfare only for the poor. So it's a lot easier to cut, of course. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And speaking of Florida, Gary in Fort Lauderdale, listening on Wins. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Tom, I got a million things on my mind, but I got two things I'd like you or one of your or some of your call listeners to respond to. Number one, oil prices are down 37%. Gas at the pump is down 5%.
Yep.
Who is stealing the 32%? That's the first question.
Well, let me give you a real quick answer, Gary. Gas is down, oil is down, and it's going to stay that way until the election.
I knew that, Tom. I knew that for years.
And then, you know, on November 5th, it's going to go back up. I was saying this a year ago. I was saying 2 years ago. I was saying, watch, you're going to see the price of gas is going to get jacked up like crazy in the months leading up to the election. And then 3 months before the election, you're going to see the price of gas fall and the price of oil fall. And, you know, it always happens. You've got an oil man who's a president. You got an oil man who's a vice president. You're the Secretary of State, has a tanker named after her, Condoleezza Rice. And we're surprised.
How about this one? Could the U.S. bailout of all these financial companies be the basis or the excuse given for privatizing Social Security?
Yes.
I agree.
Yeah. They've been pushing that forever. I mean, George Bush in 1977 in his unsuccessful run for the U.S. House of Representatives, his singular campaign, his singular issue was privatizing Social Security. John McCain is a big advocate of partial privatization of Social Security, which ultimately, of course, will lead to privatization, total privatization. This has been the Republicans' wet dream ever since 1936, the year after it was signed into law. They have hated Social Security from the beginning. They've considered it socialism. And the sop that the Democrats gave them, and this is amazing. The Democrats said, okay, fine, we'll make it so it's definitely not socialism. Only people who make, now, you know, when it was created, I think it was like $6,000 a year or something. Maybe it was even $3,000 a year. As recently as, you know, during the Reagan era, it was only $30,000 a year. Now it's $102,000 a year, I believe. Only people who make up to 100, in other words, basically the middle class, even up to the bottom end of the upper middle class. Only the middle class will pay Social Security taxes. And everybody, even Bill Gates, can claim Social Security. So, you know, it's far from, you know, socialization or anything like that, you know, socialism. But that's not good enough for them. They still just want to get it. They just want to do away with it because they can't stand the idea that we might be a we society instead of a me society. And here we have, and thanks, Gary, for the call. Here we've got all these predators running off, these CEOs of these big companies. I say, Give the money back. Give us back that friggin' money. You took that money. You took that pay for all those years. You ran those companies into the ground. Give it back to us. If we, the taxpayers, are now picking up the bill, you can pick up your part of it. If I'm going to be taxed $937 this year for the bailout of AIG, and by the way, I'm not going to be taxed for it because, of course, this is a Republican administration. Instead, what they're going to do is they're going to add interest to it. So over the next 20 years, it's going to become more like $2,000 or $3,000, and they're going to tax my children. And so if they're going to be taxed for it, I'd like to see that money come out of the hide of some of these CEOs. But time will tell. Gerald in Pennsylvania. Hey, Gerald.
Yeah, I was wanted to respond to that idiot who wrote that book.
Yeah, I don't think we can call him an idiot. Brad Miner, the conservative.
Okay,
yeah.
But the thing about it is the whole philosophy and all this, the stuff behind it just was illogical. The repercussions of the war that they started over there haven't even finished. We're looking at World War III. The Arabs formed a group. They don't want the Americans over there. Pakistan's been given permission to fire on American soldiers, all right? And our economy's failing, which means we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable to attack. We don't have the largest army anymore. The schoolhouse bully is now about to start getting bullied if we don't straighten our act up.
We're not just about to get bullied. You know, we're bailing out AIG because if AIG went
not that way. When you got other countries, which, because if
Look at Russia. Russia is building embassies in South Ossetia and Pakistan whatever the country is there, the other one, they're talking about it. We're no longer able to play bully, which is frankly I think in many ways a good thing. But Pakistan is saying they're going to shoot us at us if we come in. You're absolutely right. And this is just. And by the way, the reason why the so-called surge is working, the surge is not working. We need to take that out of our vocabulary. The reason violence is down is because Anbar province. Look on a map. It's more than half of Iraq, or in the neighborhood of half of Iraq. And the Sunni area of Iraq, the Anbar, the Sunni areas of Iraq, the reason that they're not shooting at us, we're paying them not to. We're paying them not to. And they're reaching the point now where they're saying, you know, if you don't get the hell out of our country, we don't care how much money you give us, we're going to start shooting at you again. I mean, this is just nuts. Marie in Vashon Island. Hey, Marie.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for all you do. I'm calling about Mr. Miner. And his book. I just wanted to say, those Republicans, they don't let facts get in their way. If we're planning to leave, why are we building the largest embassy in the world and we're still building bases there?
Yeah.
And Abu Ghraib, how can he say that wasn't a big deal? We go in saying we're going to free these people and we torture them.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of this American exceptionalism. We're better and somehow more moral than anybody else, which has been
proven
completely wrong.
Yeah, and here's the problem. If that's going to be the position that we're going to take, then we damn well better live it out.
And we're not.
right. We're definitely not under this administration. We're running around saying we're in favor of free speech, and then we support the Chinese who put, you know, anybody who wants to speak out in prison. We say we're in favor of human rights, and they're killing people in Tibet. We say that we're in favor of democracy, and Condi Rice goes over and is making kissy face with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Come on, give me a break. Good point. Marie, thank you very much for the call. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, got a minute before the break. What's up?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. I just want to say a quick thing. You know, this all could have been prevented had Roosevelt, after the New Deal, prosecuted Prescott Bush, J.P. Morgan, and all the others that were planning to have him assassinated, because he was worried about what it would do to the economy. Had this been done...
He actually wasn't worried about the economy. This was all before the war had started. And the fascists in the United States, you know, people like Charles Lindbergh, I mean, some very famous people were pro-German and pro-fascism in the United States. And he was concerned that if it was publicized, it actually might lead to an overthrow. It might actually lead to a coup. I suspect that had Roosevelt lived after the war, he would have gone back and prosecuted it. If you want to lay this at somebody's feet, I'd lay it at Harry Truman's feet for failure to prosecute it. But it's the same thing. I mean, you have not just Roosevelt and Truman. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a coup planned against Roosevelt, and he suppressed the newspaper coverage of it. But beyond that, There were crimes committed by the Reagan administration that were never prosecuted by the Clinton administration. There were crimes committed by the Nixon administration that were never prosecuted by the Carter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Mike in Texas. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you know, I'm hearing on the news and a lot of people talking about the government bailout of AIG. And
well, it's actually a loan. It's not a bailout.
Well, and my concern is it's not the government. People are saying the taxpayers are bailing them out, and the Fed is not a government branch. A lot of people, I guess, don't know that, but yeah. Why would this group of investment bankers that own the Fed be interested in helping AIG, but not interested in helping, you know, when it came to Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs and Fannie Mae?
Because if Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs went down, it doesn't take down all these banks that collectively own the Fed. If AIG goes down, because AIG is the company that insures the securities that these banks sold.
Right.
Here's how it works. You and I get a mortgage, and let's say your mortgage is great, but my mortgage is a phony, right? You know, I've got no income or whatever. You know, it's a ninja mortgage or something. So there's a bad mortgage buried in this thing. Your mortgage and my mortgage get packaged by a mortgage packaging company or a bank, and they get sold as a security. That security, now the banks are no longer just banks. They're also investment banks, so they can get into the securities business. They sell it to China.
So
some investor in China now is sitting on a security, you know, that has a guaranteed rate of return. And what's guaranteeing that rate of return? AIG.
It's an insurance company. They're basically interested in covering their own backsides. It's not so much to protect the American consumer.
This has got nothing to do with the American consumer. What
okay.
happens is if AIG goes down, because AIG insures all of these instruments, they insure all of these bundled mortgages. And if the bundled mortgages go south, then the investors in China say, okay, that's it, I'm pulling the plug. And by the way, they are. I encourage you to go over to Asia Times. And I think it's atimes.com, but you can certainly Google Asia Times and just, you know, the big newspaper out of Hong Kong and just read today what's going on. There's panic selling going on in China right now. And this is what they're trying to stop.
Well, my concern is I heard a report that John McCain is now saying that he doesn't agree with the taxpayers are catching the burden on this. And I think he's trying to use that to his advantage when it's not us, the taxpayers.
Well, arguably it's not, but here's the problem. When the Fed loans $70 billion, the Fed has to get that money from somewhere, okay? So what the Fed has done is there's two problems that the Fed has right now. One is that Bernanke's earlier bailout, this is the bailout from a couple of weeks ago, where they acquired the assets of Fannie and Freddie and all of this. And a good chunk of the Fed's portfolio now is in questionable mortgages.
Right.
And guess who's insuring those questionable mortgages that'll keep the Fed from failing if
they
go down? AIG.
Oh, okay.
So, this is the dog chasing its tail. And the part where it gets to us is that if the Fed decides, as the Bundesbank did in the 1920s, when the German government was faced with the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, and all the European countries got together and said, okay, you guys, you know, you really didn't play World War I fair, and you're going to have to pay to rebuild our country, and you have to pay a certain, you know, a trillion marks or whatever the amount was. I have no recollection what the exact amount was, but let's just say for purposes of argument that it was a billion marks, Deutschmarks. They said, okay, that's fine. What we will do is we will inflate the currency to the point that a billion marks will buy a loaf of bread, and we'll pay you guys off with a loaf loaf of bread, basically.
And well,
that's,
and one,
that's what they did
one
in
more,
the 1920s. And that's what, by the way, my point is that's what's going to happen here if the Fed keeps doing this kind of thing. If the Fed keeps pulling, making money out of nowhere or collaborating with the Treasury to do so, or keeps plays this shell game where they're backing up the insurance company that is backing the securities that the Fed itself owns to that it is using to loan money to banks to keep banks liquid, then we're going to see hyperinflation in this country like we never saw before. You're going to see 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40% annual interest rates and conceivably even monthly interest rates if this isn't fixed.
You know, one more quick point you said at the beginning of the show about gold, the price of gold coming up. And in reality, I would think what that is, Tom, is it's not the price of gold going up. It's our dollar falling.
That's right. That's exactly what's happening.
And
it's
so that's
flee from
not,
dollars.
Not such a good thing, right?
Well, in a way. The dollar falling actually means that the value of the dollar is increasing. And which means that they're not running the printing presses quite, or at least nobody has figured out yet that they're running the printing presses quite as fast as we thought. It's not a good thing broadly. I agree with you, but it would be a terrible thing if the stock market fell and the price of gold fell at the same time.
Right.
Well, that's what happened in 1929.
Everything all right, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's this real subtle dance, and frankly. Things were put into place, the Glass-Steagall Act, which Phil and Wendy Graham and Phil Graham and his buddies, John McCain, got pulled in 1999 that prevented banks from being in the gambling business and the investment business. That's gone. All these things are gone. And McCain is running around saying, I've taken on tougher guys than these, like the Viet Cong. Yeah, right. Like doing 30 propaganda videos for the Viet Cong is going to give you a credential to take on the bankers. I'm sorry, I'm not buying it. Nancy in Minneapolis. Hey, Nancy, got a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Okay, Brad Miner,
yeah.
Who wants to put lipstick and mascara and makeup over torture our foreign policy.
Oh, he wants to put a tutu on it.
it's appalling. And I'm coming from the Twin Cities where we have the Center for Victims of Torture. We also have the home of Steve Miles, who wrote Oath Betrayed, where the military doctors were involved in the torture at Abu Ghraib. And also Colleen Raleigh has organized, who's the ex-FBI agent and Woman of the Year, who's organized a bunch of us that protest torture every week on over the I-35W. Torture is terrorism.
Yes,
we
it is.
We can't say anything else about it.
It's, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, Nancy, torture isn't, when it's publicized, as our government not just allowed happen, but I would say promoted happening, and not just the torture in Abu Ghraib, torture in the United States, torture all over the world. When it's publicized, its primary purpose isn't to torture the individual. It's to terrorize people like you and me. It's to create terror. It is a form of state terrorism. Nancy, thank you so much for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So AIG, welcome back, by the way. It's a French problem. It's a British problem. It's a Chinese problem. It's a U.S. problem. Here is, and by the way, tip of the hat to Ian Simpson for sending me a note about this. Thanks a lot. You know, sometimes people in their rhetoric aren't always the most kind, but sometimes the information is really truly useful. I appreciate this. This is from AIG's U.S. regulatory filing. Now this is the kind of language that they use to describe this, and this is why most of the media is clueless about what's going on. Approximately $307 billion. Consisting of corporate loans and prime residential mortgages, of the $441 billion in notational exposure of AIG FP's super senior credit default swap for portfolios as of June 30, 2008, represented derivatives written for financial institutions, principally in Europe, for the purposes of providing regulatory capital relief rather than risk mitigation. In exchange for a minimum guaranteed fee, the counterparties receive credit protection with respect to diversified loan portfolios they own, thus improving their regulatory capital position, end of quote. Now, here's really what it is. Here's how it works. Let's say that you or me went down to our friendly local stockbroker, that we went down to Charles Schwab or, you know, Merrill Lynch, the remnants of it, or whatever, and said, you know, I'd like to put $10,000 into, General Electric. And just for the sake of, you know, just pulling a name out of the air, I want to buy $10,000 worth of GE stock. And by the way, well, actually, let's make it a little more realistic here. Let's say I want to buy $10,000 worth of stock in Washington Mutual Bank. This is a bank you can buy stock in, or Bank of America or Wells Fargo. I want to buy $10,000 worth of stock in that bank. And they say, fine, give us a check for $10,000, we'll give you the shares. And those shares may go up in value, they may go down in value. And then if you said to that stockbroker, oh, and by the way, I would also like to spend a little bit of money on the side. Let me kick in another $50 here on the side for insurance. Now, you know, a lot of people, when they buy homes, they buy title insurance. This is sort of the same thing. You know, if you've ever bought a home, you know what title insurance is. Title insurance is you get a piece of paper when you buy a house. Or you buy land, you get a title to that land. Just like you buy a car, you get a title to the car. It says you own it. And the title to the house says, okay, the boundaries of this house are from, you know, the street, 60 yards back to what used to be the old tree back in 1804, and is now identified by a steel post that was put there by a surveyor. And then turn right 90 degrees and go 112 feet. And, you know, it's a survey, right? There's a survey. The title identifies the survey. And what that title says is this is the property you own. Here's the latitude and longitude, degrees and seconds. This is the property that you own. Now, every now and then, somebody who does surveying, and I can tell you, as a guy who at one point owned about 400 acres of the land in Vermont, and walked it with two different surveyors and came up with two different results. Every now and then, somebody who does a survey doesn't know what they're doing. Or they're using things like old stone fences that were built in 1680 that, you know, nobody's really sure who owned it then. Or back in 1841, you know, the guy said that according to the record of title, the chain of title, it was actually sold from person A to person B, but in fact person C says, hey, wait a minute, I got proof that I bought it. Whatever. So you buy the title to the land, you buy the land, you buy the house, and you also go to an insurance company and you say, you know, even though everything looks like it's kosher, everything looks like it's copacetic, everything looks like it's on the up and up here, just in case this title is no good or there's some kind of error in it or mistake, just in case somebody's going to come along and say, you know, 2 feet of that property that you think is yours is actually mine. I want to buy some insurance. So if 10% of my land gets sliced off, I get compensated for it. Or if my title is no good, I get paid back. And there are companies called title insurance companies that will sell you that insurance. And it's a fairly routine thing. So that's, you know, an example I think most Americans, any American who's ever bought a house, can relate to. Okay. So now we go back to the stock brokerage. You go to the stock brokerage and you say, you know, I want to buy $10,000 worth of, Wells Fargo Bank or Bank of America or Washington Mutual. Washington Mutual is probably a little shakier. And by the way, I'd like to buy some insurance that if that company has been lying on their balance sheets about the quality of their assets, in other words, if they say that they're worth $1 billion and they got 1 million shareholders, and so each share is worth $1,000 if they're valuing the company at exactly, you know, asset value, which isn't really how you value companies, but just for the hell of it. If they say the company's worth has $1 billion worth of assets, but it turns out that in fact it doesn't have $1 billion worth of assets. It only has $100 million worth of assets or $5 million worth of assets. Or in the case of Enron, it has negative assets. It's actually in debt. You will insure my investment. So if the price of the stock that I bought in that bank goes down, the stock equivalent of title insurance, the insurance that I'm going to buy from you for the extra $50, the insurance company is going to come in and say, okay, you know, your price of your stock went down because they lied about their asset value. Here's your money back. You with me so far? It's like title insurance on a house, only it's insurance on an investment. Now, the fact of the matter is, if you or I walked into a brokerage house and asked for that, they'd laugh at us. We can't do it. We can't buy it. But if China buys $100 billion or $500 billion worth of securities, worth of packaged securities, packaged by banks, they can buy insurance against that. They can buy insurance that those really are what they say. There's two levels of protection. One is the rating agencies, Moody's and whatnot, and we're finding that there's been some questions about how they've been doing their job. And the other is this insurance that basically says, yeah, we're going to make sure that these assets, because they're not really assets, not really physical assets. It's not like it's a building. It's actually mostly IOUs. It's bundled mortgages. It's corporate IOUs. It's IOUs. We're going to make sure that this thing is safe. Okay? So the company that does that, American Insurance Group, AIG, or American International, rather, and they're saying, yeah, you know, no problem. And so now we find ourselves in this very, very strange situation where the Fed, AIG's assets, are not enough to cover what the insurances that they've been offering. And so the Fed, this private agency that is owned by its member banks, which are owned by stockholders, about half of whom are outside the United States, the Fed is now saying, okay, we'll loan you the money. Not to worry. So everybody can just stop panicking. So that the people in China can stop panicking. Why? Because we want them to continue to buy our debt. Why? Because we don't make anything in the United States anymore. This is what it all gets down to, what it all boils down. You can take the entire thing, take all this technical stuff, and throw it. It all comes down to this. Ever since Ronald Reagan came into office, and this insane economic policy that said, oh, we don't have to actually generate wealth in the United States anymore. We don't have to actually make things. Instead, we can just move money around and skim a little off the top as we're moving it around. That's an appropriate way to make wealth. So instead of making tennis shoes in the United States, we're going to make them in Malaysia. Instead of making televisions in the United States, RCA is going to make them in China. Instead of making radios in the United States, we're going to make them in Taiwan. Instead of making computers in the United States, we're going to make them in Mexico. We're going to make our cars in Mexico. And we're no longer generating wealth, real wealth, in the United States. We're just playing this shell game. And because that's the only thing we have to sell is our debts, we got to make sure that it's guaranteed.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No surplus, now it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Yes, the balance of our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell the kids they'll have to pay. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. try to pay these bills, or sell Dick Cheney's pills, or put Congress on eBay. And we owe.
Yep, we are flat out broke.
Alone, ain't no surplus. Now it's gone.
No, it's gone. Yeah. See, this is what we're seeing here. And again, the Democrats should be running attack ads on this right now, every single day. They should be quoting Grover Norquist in 2002 when he was on NPR with Mara Liasson. And my recollection is it was May of 2002. I may be wrong. I quoted it in two of my books, a couple of articles I wrote on Common Dreams. You can track it down. Grover Norquist said, we don't want to destroy government. We simply want to shrink it down to the size where it's small enough to drag into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub. They have done it. The conservatives have done it. Looking at the front page of the business section of today's New York Times, here's a couple of really scary stories. Number one, Barclays, the British bank. Guess who's buying the assets of Lehman Brothers? The assets are still worth, you know, a little over $1 billion, $1.75 billion. Barclays. See, we got nothing left to sell. We can't sell them cars that we don't make here anymore. Even the cars that are being made in Detroit, a large chunk of their stuff is coming from overseas. I mean, basically, we've got two U.S. automakers left, Ford and General Motors. Say, oh, well, we're making Toyotas in the United States. Yeah, and where's the profit going? Japan. Oh, we're making Chryslers in the United States. Where's the profit going? Germany. Oh, we're making Hondas in the United States. Where's the profit going? Japan. See, we got nothing left. We're very, very little. This is Mitt Romney's business. You know how Mitt Romney became worth $400 or $500 million? Was buying up companies, shutting down their, to a large extent, shutting down their U.S. operations, moving their manufacturing overseas, and increasing their profits. We don't make things here anymore. If you can take a $50 ton of, or whatever it costs for a ton of cotton, and convert that into $1 million worth of designer clothes, you have added value. You have created real wealth. If you can take a $1,000 pile of ore, of iron ore, slag, and you can purify it and refine it and convert it into steel and make it into an automobile and sell it as a luxury car, you've taken $1,000 worth of stuff and you've added some labor to it and some technology to it, and you turn it into millions of dollars worth of cars. You have created real value. We don't create real value in the United States anymore. We instead ask the Chinese to do it for us, and by the way, they're keeping the money. We ask the Japanese to do it for us. They're keeping the money. We're asking the Vietnamese to do it for us. They're keeping the money. We're asking the Germans to do it for us. They're keeping the money. What do we do here in the United States? We have money markets. We basically buy and sell cash. And now, and this is going to rattle some cages. I'm telling you, this is going to rattle some huge cages. In a new sign of market turbulence, Diana Henrique is writing in today's New York Times. In a new sign of market turbulence, managers of a multi-billion-dollar money market fund said on Tuesday that customers might lose money in the fund. They had almost $65 billion in assets at the end of May. It's part of the Reserve Fund, a group whose founder helped invent the money market fund more than 30 years ago. Right now, if you've got a dollar in that fund, they can give you 97 cents. Used to be people put money in money market funds because it was safe. No, they're not FDIC insured. Yes, they did have good rates of return, better than banks. They're not insured. My personal advice, you know, this isn't financial advice. I'm not qualified to give financial advice, but I'll tell you what I did. I had some money in a money market fund and sent a note to the guy at our bank yesterday, or I sent it to Louise yesterday. She sent it to him this morning. Said, I want all of my money out of money market funds. Now, it's not like we've got a pile of money there anyway, but, you know, put it in a just good old-fashioned 2% savings account. Because like a dummy last week, I sold about half of my savings that we had that was in asset-based securities. Now gold is up $60. So of course, it's Murphy's Law. But in any case, I'm telling you, what we are seeing here is Reaganomics on steroids. We don't make anything of value in the United States anymore. So all we can do is move money around. The only reason the world is playing this game with us is because the dollar is the currency in which oil is traded. And now we've got countries like Venezuela, which is a major supplier of oil, Iran, which is talking about doing it, another major supplier of oil. Russia could do it. They have subtly threatened to do it. We've got a number of countries that are major suppliers of oil saying, you know, maybe we're not going to take dollars anymore. And if that happens, we are so screwed. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Interesting little facts. Again, as I mentioned, Asia Times, this is atimes.com. This has become one of my favorite newspapers. Their opinions tend to be more, you know, right-wing than not. I mean, you know, what can you say? It's like it's the Financial Times. I don't even read the Wall Street Journal anymore. It's just Rupert Murdoch on steroids. But the collapse of U.S. insurance giant AIG and its $85 billion takeover by the U.S. government on Tuesday takes the U.S. financial crisis right to the heart of China's development as a capitalist country. It's the lead article in the China business section of the Asia Times today. And AIG, the world's sixth largest company by assets and biggest insurer, according to the Forbes Global 2000 list for 2007, is one of the few U.S. institutions to be founded in China. Its roots dating from 1918, when Cornelius van der Staar, a veteran of World War I, founded a small insurance company in Shanghai called American Asiatic Underwriters, later to become AIG. A few other things I wanted to share with you. This push polls are happening. You will recall that John McCain was targeted in the 2000 election with push polls where they called registered Republicans in South Carolina and said, you know, ask a few questions and to determine that they actually were talking to registered Republicans who were probable voters. And then they said, and this was not a lie, it was a question. They said, how would it change your vote if you knew? In other words, they didn't say it was true. They asked it as a question. How would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain had an out-of-wedlock African-American child? Now, John and Cindy had adopted a dark-skinned girl from India or Bangladesh, I forget which, and from one of Mother Teresa's orphanages. This is, you know, a sweet thing, actually, that Cindy did years ago. Adopting this girl with a cleft palate, brought her back here for surgery, and then decided to keep her. And I don't mean that in some kind of frivolous way. But anyhow, you know, people, there was that picture of the McCains with that dark-skinned child, and sure enough, and then they asked the question, how would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain had been treated for psychiatric problems as a result of the stress of being a prisoner of war? How would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain was on psychiatric medications because of the stress of the war? You know, they never asked the question that really could have nailed it. How would it change your vote if you knew that John McCain's wife, Cindy, had stolen narcotics from a charity that she set up or helped set up to feed her own habit? I mean, that part was actually tragically true. But in any case, the rest of it wasn't true. And this push-pull is what cost John McCain the 2000 nomination to be the Republican candidate for President of the United States. So now it's happening today. And it's happening, we have a fair amount of evidence that it's happening to Jewish voters. Jewsvote.org is the website that has done a pretty good, is doing a good job of starting to document this. But apparently this company called Research Strategies, a long history of working with the Republican candidates. Jolena Marcus received a phone call to her Key West residence that went like this. She was asked if she was Jewish. She replied in the affirmative. She was asked if she was religious. Then she was asked if her opinion of Barack Obama would change if she knew that Obama had given lots and lots of money to the PLO. You get this? You get how this kind of stuff is going on? I mean, this is another one. This Minden, Debbie Minden, she's a psychologist, works in the Jewish community of Squirrel Hill. She received a call from an identified number, began with relatively innocuous questions. This is an article by Ben Smith over at Politico, politico.com. You can read the thing. Began with relatively innocuous questions about which organization she belongs to, whether she prefers CNN or Fox, Obama and McCain on a range of issues, national security to the economy. Then the caller asked if she was Jewish. Sounded like a real poll, said Minden. Then the caller asked if she recalled, would it change your mind about Obama if you knew that his church was anti-Israel? Would it change your mind if you knew that the leaders of Hamas had endorsed Obama? Would it change your mind if you knew that he had met with the leaders of Hamas? She said one question asked if it would change her mind if she learned he were a Muslim, though she didn't recall the precise wording. The poll lasted about 15 minutes. Marcus gave a similar account to JewsVote.org's Mick Moore, who wrote in an email that Marcus was asked if her opinion of Barack Obama would change if she knew that he had given money to the PLO. Update. Jewish readers in New Jersey and Philadelphia report getting the call, as did the New Republic's Michigan-based Jonathan Cohn, who took notes and lists the negative messages. And there's just this whole list of them. The push polls, the slander of Barack Obama has begun big time. And this is heavy duty, official, very expensive stuff being done by the campaign of John McCain or by the RNC or by some 527 that wants to see this happen. And this is cancer. This is the toxic stuff that is designed to destroy democracy in the United States. This is the win at all costs mentality. This is so destructive. This is so destructive. It needs to be called out. It needs to be pointed out. These people need to be held up to the light and watch them scurry, right? They need to be held up to the light and shown for what they are and for what they're doing. Tony in New York City. Hey, Tony, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Always great listening to you.
Thank you.
I've got an interesting supposition. Earlier in the year, we had been hearing about oil prices being pushed up by speculators and hedge funds. And hedge funds, I'm just wondering if there may be any that the hedge funds were borrowing on the margins from Lehman, and then once they were kind of like called out on that, the cash flow stopped to Lehman. Does that sound like any? Because I haven't heard anything about hedge funds.
It could be. It could be. I suspect that yesterday Cramer was going off on this long screed, on his CNBC show about the short sellers, about the guys who are betting that the market will go down. You can buy puts or calls, and if you buy the type of bet basically that says that the market goes down, when the market goes down, you make a pile of money, and in a small way that, it's kind of like a way of protecting your investment. You buy some GM stock and then you buy, insurance essentially against it going down. But that's if, you're buying 100 shares of GM. But if you're big enough that you can buy thousands or tens of thousands of puts or millions of puts, you can buy huge quantities of bets that the market will go down. What happens is that there is a reporting mechanism for the fact that these are being bought. These puts, the puts, or if the market is going up, calls. And the traders look at that and they go, hey, wait a minute. There's some huge institutions that are betting hundreds of millions of dollars on the margin because, you know, these puts and calls are basically, you know, you lose the whole thing if you lose. So it's really just a bet is all it is. It's a bet. There's no, you're not buying an asset at all. And they say, look at all these people who are betting that the price of the stock is going to go down. I guess I better sell. And so people sell, and guess what? As more and more of the stock becomes available for sale, fewer and fewer people are willing to buy it, and the price of the stock goes down. So these short sellers, now it used to be that if you short sold, you had to actually have enough money to buy the stock, you know, in the event that the price of the stock went up and you lost that thing. But these naked shorts, you know, the ability to do this, what is fundamentally, actually, I believe illegally, certainly should be illegal. I think it is. But nobody's enforcing it. I mean, you know, they're just not enforcing this. So I think that what we're seeing is a number of very, very large and powerful and incredibly wealthy speculators just basically making a pile of money off manipulating the market, manipulating it up, manipulating it down. And we used to have protections against this. And the main man in the United States, actually a couple, Phil and Wendy Graham, who are responsible for destroying these protections. Wendy doing away with the protections against the ability to bet on commodities so that Enron, which she was a member of the board, could make all the money that they made and run off happily with it. And Graham with the Graham Leach thing saying that, or not Graham Leach, I forget the name of the legislation, it's Graham and two other senators. This piece of legislation that said that did away with Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 that said that banks.
Bailey.
Yeah, it could be. That said that banks couldn't bet. They couldn't become investment houses, basically. You know, if you're a bank, you got to be a bank. It's a nice, boring business. It's predictable. It's, you know, nice profit, 2, 3, 5% a year, but not much more than that. But now banks can become casinos. They can gamble. And Phil and Wendy Graham, I would say, are probably more responsible for this. Now, of course, the person who set the stage for it was Ronald Reagan and his advisors. And Alan Greenspan, and then you got Tom Friedman being a cheerleader for this kind of stuff. Although today in the Wall Street Journal or in the New York Times, he's saying essentially that everything he said is wrong. Although he doesn't point that out, but you've got all of this. You know, this Friedrich von Hayek actually was the guy who started this stuff. But that's now we're getting back into the 30s and 40s and Milton Friedman at the Chicago School. But the bottom line is, these guys were wrong. This conventional wisdom of the so-called free market and isn't it wonderful and we need to just let everybody do anything that they want and don't worry, it'll all correct itself. Well, yeah, it will correct itself. And the way it'll correct itself is the really rich predators will become mind-bogglingly rich predators. The middle class will become impoverished.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen Ratner is going to be with us in just a second. First, Stephen in Danville, California, who apparently knows a whole lot more than I do about short selling because it's something I've frankly never done. Stephen, drop on the line here. In fact, I'll put you on the line.
Tom, I can hear you.
What's the deal, Stephen?
Well, I had a 10-year career in the stock market, and one of the things I did was actually managing the stock loan for some of these accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it used to work for the non-naked short selling is you physically had to be able to borrow the shares from stock loan. Those were shares that were purchased on margin.
Right. Now, for our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, when you're short selling, you basically borrow shares. Say the shares are 10 bucks. You borrow those shares at $10, and you say, I'm going to bet that this share is going to sell at 7.
Right.
And
you have to put up $5 for the share as your initial margin requirement when you borrow it. So
right.
It used to be 50% margin.
Right.
If the stock went the wrong way and it went up on you, say it went from 10 to 15, well, then you're subject to a margin call because you've got to maintain 25% margin.
Right. So then you've got to actually sell that stock at that higher price and take the loss. That'd be the margin call.
Unless you either pay the margin call or you sell the stock at a loss.
Right.
What's
so naked
now,
shorts is where neither of those things happen.
Right. Nobody borrows it. You just sell it. And
Something you don't even own.
Something you don't even own. And right. In these days of short settlement, it used to be you had 5 days to make settlement.
Right.
And it's less than that now. They should not be able to get away with this, but clearly they do.
Oh, they do it constantly. They do it every day.
I know, but it used to be that if you sold naked and you hadn't borrowed the shares, you ended up with what they called in the industry an FTA, FTD, failure to deliver.
Right.
Because you had to deliver the shares by Depository Trust Corp.
And that's not just an economic problem. That's also a crime, is it not?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a form of fraud, if nothing else.
Right.
So my understanding is that the lack of oversight and regulation on this stuff in large part has to do with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Republican Securities and Exchange Commission, Stephen Cox is the chairman, as I recall.
Yes.
I may have his name wrong, but yeah, okay. Is basically just not doing their job.
They're looking the other way.
Yeah, because the Bush administration, they say, don't do your job. Just like down in Texas right now. There's no fly zones over part of Galveston Island or the islands near Galveston because there's bodies floating in the water. And they will not allow helicopters to fly over that so that the news agencies can't show us the bodies.
And they're broadcasting that they have no idea how many people were washed out to sea, yet they're not letting the news fly over.
Right. And you can't, by the way, you can't fly over the sea to see the bodies because they don't want people to know that they screwed up so badly all over again. Yeah, okay. Stephen, thank you so much for that.
I'll see you Friday.
Okay, great,
okay,
great.
Yep.
Look forward to it.
Okay.
And that Friday that he's talking about, by the way, Friday night of this week, the 19th, 7 to 9 p.m., the Broadway Studios in North Beach, San Francisco. It'll be an evening with me and Norman Solomon, one of my favorite people, hosted by Green 960's Angie Cuero. And details are at green960.com, so check it out. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. On the web. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Dana Perino had a briefing today, and a lot of it, of course, focused on the economy. And it was interesting because she was pressed by one of my colleagues about the question of the fundamentals of the economy being the same or being okay. And she would only say, and she said it a few times, that our country has the strength to be able to deal with this. And so would not really talk about whether the fundamentals of the economy are okay or not. And she also, though, said that you can't lay all this at the feet of the Republicans. She said that Secretary Paulson had laid out a regulatory blueprint which encouraged transparency and oversight. She was also asked whether this was a guarantee, whether there was this is the last bailout, and she basically said, you know, there are no guarantees at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then asked why there was not going to be why the president hadn't a press conference in almost 2 months. She said because almost everything is geared towards the election and that the president doesn't want to be caught up in that. She, though, did not say whether there wouldn't be any more. She did not say that he wouldn't do any more press conferences before the election, but she did say that that was one of the reasons. She also said that...
It seems, by the way, if I may interrupt you, it seems that John McCain is not doing press conferences anymore.
I know.
It's been over a month.
I mean, these guys are being silent and controlling message to the nth power.
They've become like Bush and Cheney.
Right.
Sometimes
the parties begin to look alike after a while.
Yeah.
The Department of Commerce reported that the account deficit rose to $183 billion. That's $2 billion more than they expected. Housing starts were down very sharply last month, 6.2% in August.
Wow.
So... they said economists had expected a smaller drop of 1.6%.
Right.
That's the lowest since January 1991.
I'll bet they saw that number coming when they were sitting down, when the Fed was sitting down deciding that they were going to bail out AIG.
Oh, I am sure. And also Barney Frank this morning held something, a hearing today at the Financial Services Committee, she said that the, Sheila Blair, she's chairman of the FDIC, and she said the current housing market is due to a complex set of interrelated causes, but she did say the housing market in the United States had had this most severe drop in the past, of the past 60 years.
Wow.
One other thing, today.
If I can just add to that, Ellen, just for our history junkies, Google 1927 Florida real estate, bubble. In the early 1920s, Florida real estate went through like 120 to a 200% increase in value, the early 1920s. That bubble burst in 27, and that led right to the stock market crash in 1929, which is what I'm afraid we're seeing all over again.
These are very scary times.
They really are. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you do know, and sometimes everything you know is wrong.
Right, Chris? Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, today is Constitution Day, actually. It's the anniversary of our Constitution, the 221st anniversary of the U.S. Constitution. And with us is Melanie Miller. She holds degrees in aeronautical engineering and law, received her Ph.D. in American history, the author and editor of several books on Governor Morris, most recently An Incautious Man, The Life of Governor Morris. Melanie, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
First of all, why the odd spelling of governor? That was just the archaic spelling of governor?
No, he was never a governor.
So that was his name?
That was his name. It was a Huguenot name through his mother.
But how is it pronounced?
Well, there's a debate on that, but I just say gouverneur.
Gouverneur. Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. When I was writing What Would Jefferson Do, I spent 3 years reading about 10,000 of Thomas Jefferson's letters. And he had quite a relationship with him. I mean, this is from November 26, 1790. To Governor Morris, I have yet to acknowledge the receipt of your two favors, April 1st, July 7. And he goes through all this stuff. He says, the president has not yet returned, though expected tomorrow. The declaration and counter-declaration established was a full expectation that peace would be continued. Perhaps this is the most rational occupation, though the English papers continue to talk of preparations of war. And here he's talking about, I believe, the French Revolution. I'd have to read into this. I don't recall which of these wars he was talking about. But Governor Morris and the French Revolution had a relationship.
Yes, they certainly did. Morris had, well, actually, as of that date, he hadn't quite yet replaced Thomas Jefferson as our, I guess I'd call him ambassador to France. They really were called
him. He was attaché, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Minister.
That's right. And Jefferson had actually left in 1789, but they had both been in Paris for a few months together and had gotten to know each other. But Morris wasn't appointed until 1792, and he was there during the worst of the terror. So the France he experienced was quite a bit different than what Jefferson went through.
Right. Now, this being the French Revolution, this when Maximilian Robespierre rose to power, what was the assembly called?
Well, it was called a number of things as it went through many different permutations and different regimes, but it started out as the National Assembly.
Right, but then there was a name for it when they started beheading people.
Oh, well, maybe you're thinking of the Committee of Public Safety.
Yeah.
Or the Mountain.
Exactly. And Thomas Paine even went over there. He thought that he could work things out. He spent a couple of weeks in the United Kingdom with Sir Edmund Burke, stayed at his house, got so pissed off at Burke that he wrote the Rights of Man as a rebuttal to Burke's conservative worldview,
right.
And then went on over to France, arguing with the French that they should take Louis and Marie and ship them off someplace, maybe the United States, but get them out of the country. And so they threw his butt in jail and sentenced him to death. James Madison, as I recall, or was it Monroe? It was one of the other talk them out of killing.
We could back up a little on
that.
Great. Morris actually knew Payne pretty well, and he had mixed feelings about him. He said he had a wonderful
pen. As did many people of that time.
Yes, well, he said he had a wonderful pen to write, but an indifferent head to think.
Yes.
And the thing was that Payne had been elected as a delegate to the French Assembly, and when his particular group of cronies were taken out of power, they all got executed. He was lucky. He just was thrown into jail.
Right.
And he demanded that Morris get him out. And Morris did speak to the ministers there about it, but there was no denying that he had acted as a French citizen, and he really couldn't make a claim that he shouldn't be in jail for that reason.
Payne.
So, anyway, he finally got out when Robespierre fell.
Yeah, yeah, and came back to the United States, and as a result of this being Thomas Paine, as a result of writing his book promoting atheism, essentially the Age of Reason,
mm-hmm.
Was so shunned that only 7 people showed up at his funeral in New York.
Well, he spent his old age writing mean songs about Morris.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
So tell me about Morris's, Morris is one of the guys, I mean, I bounced off him a whole bunch of times when I was writing books about Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And because Jefferson was constantly corresponding with him and taking him into his confidences. And in fact, Morris is the guy, if my recollection is correct, and it's been a few years, but Morris is the guy that Jefferson in his letters says told him that George Washington told Morris that he would have nothing to do with the Christian religion. Is that recollection correct?
Well, now, actually, there you have got me. I don't really remember that.
I'll have to send you a copy of the letter.
All I can say is that Morris himself was called irreligious and profane, and yet he did actually have some a modicum of religion. He was quiet about it, but so that may be the case. But I'm not sure it was true. Jefferson did have a tendency to. Well, of course, Jefferson's attitude about religion was not very supportive either. So.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. The quote, as I recall, is. Governor Morris, who claims to be in Washington's confidence, has assured me that George Washington no more believes in the Christian religion than he does. And there was some metaphor, but it's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? I'll have to track it down. I'm sorry I don't have it right.
I'll have to read
fingers.
It.
Yeah. So in any case, why should we care about Governor Morris today?
Well, I think he's really the most engaging of the founding fathers, and he's just a national treasure that seems to have been overlooked. He was really funny, and I think that's one of the reasons Washington really liked him, because he made him laugh. And he was a wonderful writer, just a wonderful writer and a wonderful speaker, and he had a lot to do with the Constitution and the way he actually wrote the preamble to the Constitution, as we know it. And
he wrote We the People.
That's right, he did. And that was because the original version of that was simply a list of the 13 states, which just emphasized the idea that people felt like they were citizens of individual states and not of a whole nation. And so he rewrote it to say We the People of the United States. And he was extremely smart in things like math and finance. He wrote works on the public credit that Alexander Hamilton, who was his good friend, definitely relied on. And his experience in France really deserves a lot of attention, because that was a tough job being over there during the Terror. He was all by himself, and a lot of the people that he knew and that Jefferson had known were guillotined, and he had to help Americans get out of jail and help get American ships released, and it was pretty thankless.
He was not one of the. He was definitely not one of the 3 men involved with the XYZ affair during the Adams presidency.
No, but he knew about them. He was actually still in Europe at the time that happened,
mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't surprise him, because Talleyrand, who was the one who was demanding the bribes in that affair, had been the lover of Morris's longtime mistress, and had had a child by her. So he knew Talleyrand very well.
Oh, that's interesting. And Lafayette as well. Lafayette, again, back to Jefferson. I'm sorry I keep dragging him into it, but I know a lot about him and not a lot about Morris. Jefferson translated in the second and third years of his presidency the writings of Desuet de Tracy, the founder of the French liberal school of economics.
Uh-huh.
And he had to do it in secret, because if Napoleon found out that an American president was translating what was considered seditious economic, the idea that people should have private property and that they should, basically pro-democracy stuff, Jefferson was afraid would declare war against the United States. And so he sent this stuff to Lafayette, with all these qualifications, all these letters saying, please don't ever let anybody see this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Lafayette was a great friend of the United States, mm-hmm. and the Marquis de Lafayette, and also a friend of Morris's.
Well, that's right. But again, there's another story there, because Lafayette, when the king fell, Lafayette fled France. This was in 1792, and he was captured by the Austrians and spent the next 5 years in an Austrian prison, which is really an ordeal. And Morris spent, I think one of the reasons Morris decided to stay in Europe after he was removed from being minister in Paris was in order to try and get him out. And he had a lot to do with Lafayette being released.
Hmm.
So, but he never approved of Lafayette's role in the revolution. He thought Lafayette was too ambitious and not talented enough to really help France safely reform itself.
Yeah, well, I think, many people would have argued that about Paine as well.
Oh, yes.
so it's fascinating times. Today, a great day for us to remember that our Constitution is 221 years old. And Melanie Miller, a marvelous book, and An Incautious Man, The Life of Gouverneur Morris. And Melanie, thanks. Good luck with your book, and thanks for coming by.
Well, thank you very much.
Great conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott with VA Watchdog will be up, and then we'll be picking up your calls at 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com for our live chat room.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The conservative weapons of mass deception. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Our program brought to you in part by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, particularly sponsors on our local stations. Let them know you're listening. Let them know that you'll buy their products. Let them know that if you can't buy their products or don't need their products, you'll recommend their products to your friends. Help our sponsors. They keep us on the air, my friends. And including one of our favorite sponsors, the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. You can find out more about them at teamster.org. And as always, Sue Nethercutt in our chat room, always so on top of things. This is the quote. This is from a piece that I wrote for Common Dreams must have been 3-4 years ago. This is a quote from Jefferson's diary, Thomas Jefferson's diary. However, he's talking about George Washington. He says, however, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their... This was the Presbyterian ministers that asked him whether he believed in God and was a Christian. And he says, however, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, particularly except that which he passed over without notice. And Washington never did say a word on the subject of religion in his public papers, except in his valedictory letter to the governor of the states, where he resigned his commission in the army and wherein he speaks of the, quote, benign influence of the Christian religion. I know that Gouverneur Morris, the fellow we were talking about in the last segment, who pretended to be in his secrets in Washington's confidence and believed himself to be so, has often told me that General Washington believed no more of that fundamentalist Christian system than he himself did, end of quote, Thomas Jefferson. So, just for the historical record. Larry Scott, let's change topics altogether from good, although today is the 231st anniversary of the Constitution. We were just talking with a scholar of Gouverneur Morris, one of the authors of the Constitution. But you, sir, running the notable and important and... critical, I think, website, vawatchdog.org, the place where, watching, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
Well, thank you, Tom. And I should say also we are celebrating 372 years now of veterans' rights
Wow.
in our country. 1636, the first rules and regulations were passed in the colonies to help provide benefits to those who were injured or wounded in service to the colonies when fighting in a war. So we with 372 years of veterans' rights and veterans' benefits, and I think that says a lot for this country.
The VA has flip-flopped again on allowing voter registration drives on agency property. How is a voter registration drive a partisan political event as prohibited by the Hatch Act?
Well, it really wasn't a partisan political event, and that's not what the VA argued. First of all, the VA had allowed the voter registration drives for a long time. Then a few months ago, they said no. Then they changed their mind, said yes. Then they said no. Now they've come back and said yes, and they finally put it in writing. They are going to allow nonpartisan voter registration drives. Their argument was it would interfere with health care by taking health care workers away from their chores to oversee these drives, which really wasn't a terribly good argument because functions like this are usually handled by an organization called Voluntary Services inside each VA hospital or clinic. Voluntary Services will oversee like the DAV or the VFW coming up to the campus and perhaps doing a benefit for veterans, something of that nature.
Right. This is veterans volunteering to help out veterans.
Right. And finally, what happened is the Legal Eagles, not to mention the attorneys general of 20 states, pointed out to the VA, under threat of lawsuit, by the way, that you could have voluntary services handle these nonpartisan voter registration drives. End of subject. We don't have a problem. And the VA backed off, and they said they are going to allow voter registration drives held by nonpartisan organizations. It will be overseen by the voluntary services. And so we move forward. This is good news for everyone, Tom.
Larry, I've seen numbers indicating that the contributions to the Obama campaign from active duty and recently retired military vastly outnumber those to the McCain campaign. Is that information consistent with your understanding of reality? And if so, is that, well, first of all, is that right?
That I couldn't say. I really haven't done a lot of research in that area, Tom, so I really couldn't validate that or not. If that's information that is coming out of the campaigns saying here's what we, then I think we're going to have to take their word for that. But I don't have any way to validate that at this point in time.
Yeah, okay. The VA is continuing to outsource the new GI Bill program instead of handling it by their own employees.
This is incredible. VA employees for years have handled GI Bill benefits and have done it very, very well. What happens now is we have this new GI Bill. It's going to be expensive. It's extremely complex. It's a whole new set of rules. So the VA wants to outsource this. They want a firm to build this all new computer software to handle it, and then they'll have other people, other than VA employees, do it. Nobody thinks this is a good idea. The major veterans organizations, including the American Legion, have railed against this, saying let the VA employees do the job they know how to do and know how to do well.
But look how good the outsourcing worked in Iraq. I mean, you know, the contractors built these wonderful buildings where soldiers could get electrocuted.
They outsourced a new computer system down in Florida that was supposed to be able to run a hospital, spent $340 million, and it didn't work. They've got examples. It doesn't work. They should follow the example. Let VA employees help veterans.
Really, we need to stop the crony capitalism in the United States. It is so, so very wrong. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Get over there. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It is 27 minutes past the hour right here on the Tom Hartman Program, live from San Francisco.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Bush, McCain, hail an economy as it continues to melt down, as we continue to see the utter and absolute failure of 30 years of rolling back the policies of Franklin Roosevelt, who literally saved capitalism from itself in the 1930s. As we continue to watch the absolute and utter destruction of our economy by these crazies, this John McCain, who calls himself fundamentally a deregulator. Yeah, just what we need. Just what we need. The American people are going to see through this, I'm telling you. Even the racist American people are going to see through this. Even the people who are getting the push polls, the Jewish voters who are getting the phony push polls. Pretty soon it'll be, I guarantee you, right now it's the Jewish voters getting push polls, telling them, that essentially Obama was a Muslim or something like that, some lie like that. And the next thing it's going to be white voters in Appalachia getting push polls about Barack Obama. Well, actually, the campaign's already done the ads. Barack Obama, this scary black guy wants to teach cute little white 5-year-olds all about comprehensive sex education before they even know how to read. This is an actual ad that the McCain campaign has put together. This is how low and disgusting and slimy these people are. By the way, if you believe that you are one of the folks who has gotten one of these vote caging attempts by the McCain ballot, these absentee ballot mailings, please post the information about it, the details about it, over at our website on our on the Program Today blog. Go over to TomHartmann.com and today's program. You can add a comment, put the information there. We have a serious investigative reporter. I can't give out names and details, who is wanting to collect this information, wants the contacts and the people. You don't have to put your personal contact information on there. You put your user information on there. And that, the one thing that we know about you, if you're one of our users, is what your email address is. And if you post there that you would like this reporter to contact you, that you have one of these phony absentee ballots, just with your username, then Sue will check that out, or Sean or one of the folks here, and connect that, your username, to your email address, which is the only personal information we have about you. And we'll send, with your permission, we'll send your email address to this reporter who is putting this thing together. And that would be at the homepage of TomHartmann.com. And a tip of the hat, by the way, to Lee Rayburn, who does the morning show on the mic in Madison, Wisconsin, where I'm on the air every day, and I'm on the air with Lee every Tuesday morning live. And great guy, and thanks so much, Lee, for filling in for me Thursday and Friday last week. He did a marvelous job and broke this story nationally. And as I'm sure you can tell by Googling your name anywhere on the website, anywhere on the Internet, Frank in Los Angeles. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Well, regarding the CEOs of these companies, they graduate from MBA, never had a job in their life, and they get these million-dollar jobs, and they get these parachutes. In the case of Home Depot, the guy ran the company to the ground, and someone else hired him, but they gave him $30 million to leave the company. And in the case of Ferrarino, she ran on Hewlett Packard, and they gave her $110 million to get rid of her.
Well, it was a $40 million. Her last year's compensation was $21 million, and her bonuses and pension and golden parachute was $21 million. So it was a little over $40 million is how much she walked away from in her last year. I don't know. It might have been $100 million over all the time she was there. And one of her major accomplishments was offshoring labor, moving manufacturing overseas.
What about firing 120,000 workers, plus the fact that...
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah.
and moving those jobs to China.
Yeah, they go to school, and the only thing they learn is how to privatize everything. And, they work by committee, five or ten people on a committee, and they vote on one project. So if the project fails, you can't blame anyone. You have to blame the whole committee. They're not unique, and they're not inventive. I don't want to mention his name, but he used to be head of General Electric. Like someone said, he's a copycat. When someone wants to buy a company, he goes in there and tries to buy it ahead of them. Yeah. He's not innovative.
You're talking about Jack Welch? You're talking about Jack Welch? The famous,
yeah, that's right.
The famous,
exactly,
yeah.
Him.
Yeah,
I
well,
mean,
Jack Welch,
I mean,
you know, in his autobiography. Yeah, in his autobiography, Jack Welch, the main thing that he brags about is the fact that he went to India and he got this sudden, you know, brain flash that here are all these people who speak English who are willing to work for 50 cents an hour. And General Electric has all these jobs that only require the language of English, you know, basically call center jobs and back office jobs. And so why not hire Indians? Now, China, outsourcing manufacturing to China was already well underway, but nobody was using India as a back office. And Jack Welch brags about the fact that as president of General Electric, he began that process. He's the guy who put India on the map. And as the CEO of General Electric. And he made millions and millions of dollars, and a lot of people in America lost their jobs. Spot on, Frank, spot on. And by the way, this isn't about Jack Welch being an evil guy or, for that matter, General Electric being evil. It's about our changing the rules. Because of these multimillionaire lobbyists like Phil Gramm and his wife Wendy, and who left government and became lobbyists, it's because these lobbyists are pushing these laws to change the regulations. We change the rules of the game, and therefore what these companies do is perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal. And so rather than, you know, frankly, you know, we shouldn't be going after the company. We shouldn't be sitting around here saying, oh, GE is evil, Walmart is evil. The fact of the matter is what they are doing is not good for America. And it is up to we the people, it is up to our legislators to change the laws back to what they were before Ronald Reagan came into office so that American jobs stay in America, American manufacturing is done in the United States, and if we actually want to have an economy with millions of new jobs in the new energy sector, you know, the famous saying, you know, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones, right? Tom Friedman loves to quote it. It's true. You know, the oil age is not going to end because we run out of oil. It's going to be innovation. And once that innovation happens, if it happens here in the United States, let's keep it here in the United States. And that means changing our trade policies and repudiating, pushing back, doing away with the insane idea of Tom Friedman's so-called golden straitjacket from his The Olive Tree versus the Lexus, and instead saying, we're going to do what other countries in the world that actually grow do. We're going to protect our domestic economy. Jack in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Jack.
Yeah, hey, Tom. This is based on a story which appeared in the St. Pete Times this morning. I thought you might be interested in the latest attempt by the Republicans to engage in some voter caging.
Oh, no.
This particular attempt is through a letter which is sent by the Republican National Committee and authorized by McCain, which tells voters it is seeking to double-check their, quote, unconfirmed party affiliation while asking for money. McCain's letter says, we have you registered as a Republican. Now, the upshot of the whole thing is this. The Democrats suspect a motive beyond raising money. This mailing piece has a do not forward instruction on the envelope, which means it will be returned to the GOP if a recipient has had mail forwarded, perhaps to a summer address, or has moved.
Right.
Letters returned as undeliverable can be compiled into challenge lists of unfair.
Or if somebody happens to be out of town for 2 weeks because a hurricane just came through.
Right. And the vote suppression technique, as you well know, Tom, is known as vote caging.
Yep.
So they now are targeting senior citizens in five very populous Florida counties. What do you think of that?
Five very populous Democratic-leaning Florida counties.
Right. And
yeah.
Isn't it true, Tom, that the Republican Party has an injunction against it to stop
Since the 1980s, there has been a court-ordered injunction barring the GOP from vote caging, and they're still doing it. And in fact, when I think it was Sarah, what's her name, you know, the blonde who worked for Gonzalez was testifying, and they were talking about Tim Cummings, the guy who used to be the number two guy to Karl Rove, and they asked him, you know, what did Tim do? And she says, oh, he was in charge of vote caging.
Yeah.
And the Democrats,
for respect for the law. Right?
Yeah, and the Democrats on the committee were like, vote caging, what's that? And I wanted to hop on a plane and fly to Washington, D.C. and grab these people by the lapels and go, let me tell you.
Report from Florida, okay?
Yeah, thank you very much, Jack. Thanks.
You're welcome,
Thanks a lot for the heads up. See, this is the, here you've got vote caging. These people, they don't intend to win the election by having the best ads. They don't intend to win the election by having the best policies. They don't intend to win the election by having the best personalities, even though they're saying it's all about personality. Which is code for don't vote for the black guy. They intend to win this election the old-fashioned Republican way by stealing it, by keeping people from the polls, by challenging them when they show up at the polls, by not having enough voting machines, by having riggable voting machines. The list just goes on and on and on. Mark Crispin Miller, the expert on this stuff, pick up either of his last two books. You can get all the information. Greg Palast has written about it over at gregpalast.com. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dave in L.A. Hey, Dave, thanks for waiting so long. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to give a brief explanation about regulation. I think people will help people. I can also tell you a little bit more about naked shorting if you want. But on regulation, you know, people glaze over on the financial markets. It's all meant, you know, all the terminology is meant to obfuscate everything. Otherwise, people could make money at it. But in 30 years of people being told that regulation is bad, in a simplistic term, I like to view it as a babysitter. I mean, we've all had children or, you know, been a child or had children, and but all been told at one time, fallen for the one, we don't need a babysitter this weekend when you go out of town. Everything will be fine. We can take care of ourselves.
Right.
And it never usually works out real well. If you're lucky, you know, a few beer cans, a stain on a rug. If you're really unlucky, the house is burnt down.
Yeah.
But that's what regulators are. They're the babysitters.
That's an excellent metaphor, Dave. That's an excellent one. By the way, just for the record, AIG doesn't guarantee the assets. Doesn't insure the assets. They guarantee the assets. And because they're a guarantor, they're not covered by insurance regulations. So it's even slicker than we ever thought.
On the naked shorting, Tom, there's some news today. Chris Cox came out, SEC chairman, and decided to emergency pull up of the naked, enforce the naked shorting rules to Thursday. He's starting Thursday.
Well, that's interesting. I'm guessing that was probably the result of a full 30-minute rant by either Cramer or Kudlow. I can't keep them straight.
Well, no, they've been ranting yesterday. Kramer's been ranting, saying that this is all mythology, and anybody who says there's naked shorting has been wearing a tinfoil hat for years. So is Herb. But
yesterday he was going, it's all the naked short guys.
Yeah, they changed their tune.
Yeah.
And they were subpoenaed, by the way, by the SEC, and Chris Cox jumped in the way of Kramer and Herb Greenberg. Both were deeply involved in this. And they were subpoenaed, and Chris Cox stopped that subpoena a couple of years ago. Now, what's going on with that naked shorting, real simply, what that is basically, let's put it in the analogy of selling a car. It's I sell you a car, but I don't deliver the car. And they're counterfeiting stock. This is the net result of it. They are selling things that don't exist. Right. Now, when you're forced to cover that,
which allows them, by the way, to sell a whole lot more of it than actually exists,
exactly.
which causes the numbers to be so big that they cause markets to move.
Caused markets to move, but mainly they were going after tech companies. I think there was another ulterior motive for this, but they were going after tech companies with this, and they would drive them completely out of business and then never have to cover those shares.
Well, there's even speculation this is what happened to Lehman Brothers a couple of days ago.
Well, Lehman Brothers is a little too big for this.
Yeah.
Could have happened. There was a big short seller on Lehman, and he'd been out, and he'd been very vocal that he was short for months. But the naked shorting is illegal. It's counterfeiting.
Yeah.
And what this does is it puts companies out of business. There's, and if they had to cover those shares, Tom, what is, how much is the worth of a, of the last share, the share that doesn't exist? When supply and demand curves don't meet, the theoretical price is infinity.
Right.
It's priceless.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons they didn't enforce the short selling, the naked short selling rules, the fail to delivers. They didn't enforce this at the DTCC, which is also self-regulated, regulated by the exchanges.
Jeez.
There was vested interest by the brokers all across the board on this. But they were stealing money from the public and putting companies out of business.
Right.
And,
this is a massive transfer of wealth. I mean, for a long, long time, they wanted to get their hands on our Social Security dollars because there's trillions of dollars there. They can't get our Social Security dollars, so they get the next best thing. They get our pension funds, our 401ks. This
Correct.
Is a massive transfer of wealth away, and they get all the equity in our homes and,
now,
and our cars and our credit cards.
One more thing today. We had our first money market fund go subpar. What that means is it fell below, the shares fell below a dollar.
Yeah, I talked about that earlier. This is the primary fund. And
people are going to find out that money market funds are not cash. They
right.
think they're in cash.
Right, yeah. Your banker says, oh, yeah, put it in the money market fund. You'll get 5-6% instead of the 2-3% that the bank gives you, but it's not insured, and it may actually go down. They just went down 3 cents. This
not
particular
just the bankers. 401k, if you want to get out of the market, your only choice is go to bonds or go to cash. A lot of people go to cash. That's not cash. It's a money market fund.
Right, and the money markets are simply investing in assets, some of which might be mortgages, bundled mortgages.
And they are, there are money market funds out there that have them. 401ks do not have any of the subprime stuff in it by regulation.
Oh, that's good to know. Dave, thanks a lot for the heads up and for the call. I appreciate it. I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners on earth in this program. Dave, another Dave in Woodville, Washington. Hey, Dave.
Oh, hi, Tom. I'm a Teamster driver up here in Woodinville, and I was listening to you earlier this morning talking about things aren't made here, but I deliver all day long to all these little companies that are manufacturing products that are going all over the country and to China. This one rubber company, it employs about 30 people up here, and it's just in a little business park. And they ship these bumpers that go to these docks in China. But all day long I go to these companies that are putting out all kinds of product.
Yeah, no, you're right. There is a lot of manufacturing in the United States. But at the same time, just in the last 7 years of the Bush administration, we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs in this country.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I worked for an airline for 30 years. And 4 years ago, the company just busted the union, fired 500 people in one day.
Yeah.
So I've had to retrain. But then another thing quickly, when I'm out delivering and around all these places, on my uniform shirt, I wear an Obama button. It's about a 4-inch button.
Huh.
And brother, does it stimulate a lot of, I'm so encouraged by all the young people that come up to me and start talking about Obama.
That's great.
Dave,
I'm sorry, we're out of time, but we've got to wrap it up. We'll be back tomorrow here live from Green 960, green960.com. Check out our Friday event. Tom Hartman with you. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit hartmanradio.com.